Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Kenya's president replaces key officials in the wake of a deadly militant attack. The World Bank says the Ebola epidemic has caused an economic decline in three hard-hit African countries. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has announced the replacement of his interior minister and police chief hours after a militant attack left 36 people dead. President Kenyatta announced today he is replacing Interior Minister Joseph Ole Lenku and has accepted a retirement request from the police chief David Kimayo. Both officials have been criticized for failing to stop a string of attacks. Hours earlier, the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the killings of 36 people in northeastern Kenya. Mr. Kenyatta spoke about the violence.
Our country and our people are under attack. A war has been waged against all Kenyans by an enemy hiding behind religion, and much innocent blood has been shed.
Mr. Kenyatta, a study released today by the World Bank says the Ebola epidemic is having a stark economic impact on Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and is cutting economic growth predictions for the area. Before the Ebola crisis, all three nations had strong economic growth. Libyan officials say forces loyal to Libya's internationally recognized government have carried out airstrikes in the western part of the country, killing at least 7 people and wounding about 25. Local officials say the strikes on the town of Zuwara targeted a food warehouse, a chemical plant, and a fishing port. Officials say forces loyal to a former Libyan general were conducting the campaign. This is VOA News. Local officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo are blaming Ugandan rebels for a machete attack that killed 3 people, according to the AFP. The attack that took place in North Kivu province on Monday was turned back by the army. 2 women and a child were killed, and 3 other people were seriously wounded. The mostly Muslim ADF-NALU rebels have been hiding in the mountains that straddle the border between the DRC and Uganda. The AFP reports that thousands of people today attended an official funeral for 6 people killed in the overthrow of Burkina Faso's former president Blaise Compaoré. The ceremony was held in Revolution Square in Ouagadougou. Interim President Michel Kafando and other high officials attended the funeral. This from the AFP, a Zambian political faction supporting acting President Guy Scott, has selected former President Michel Sata's nephew, Miles Sampa, to run for president. That action splits the ruling Patriotic Front Party, where another faction just yesterday nominated Defense Minister Edgar Lungu as its candidate. Elections will be held next month. The split in the ruling party raises hopes in at least 2 other parties that they might be able to win the election. The Associated Press reports Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party has opened a meeting at which President Robert Mugabe is expected to appoint a new set of loyalists to party leadership. Among those expected to be appointed is Mr. Mugabe's wife, Grace, who has been tapped to lead the party's Women's League. Chairman Simon Kayamoyo says there will be changes to the party's constitution that will abolish internal party elections and give President Mugabe greater power to make appointments. Tunisia's new parliament met today for its opening session. The country that initiated the first of the Arab Spring revolts chose a temporary National Assembly in 2011 to draw up a constitution. That document was approved early this year, and the new parliament will serve for the next 5 years. The Office of Egypt's Public Prosecutor plans to appeal a court ruling dropping murder charges against former President Hosni Mubarak. On Saturday, a court ordered authorities to drop murder and corruption charges against the former leader. Mr. Mubarak was charged in connection with the 2011 killing of protesters. The prosecutor's office says its appeal of the ruling is not influenced by disputes among political groups. The 3 founders of Hong Kong's Occupy movement are moving ahead with plans to surrender to police. They're urging fellow protesters to retreat for their own safety. At a news conference, the 3 announced they will turn themselves in to Central Police Station on Wednesday. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Two top Kenyan security officials are being replaced following a terrorist attack that left 36 people dead Tuesday in northeastern Kenya. Second such incident in 10 days. Kenya's president announced the changes while vowing to intensify Kenya's war on terrorism.
That's VOA's Gabe Joswell reporting from Nairobi. We'll have full details coming up. Also, the Ebola epidemic is having a stark economic impact on Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Cameroon says it is recruiting 20,000 more defense and security forces to fight Boko Haram. And Malawi's president is under fire for giving envelopes containing $125 to more than 80 media people at a dinner he hosted. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, two top Kenyan security officials are being replaced following a terrorist attack that left 36 people dead today in northeastern Kenya. The second such incident in 10 days. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports Kenya's president announced the changes while vowing to intensify Kenya's war on terrorism.
In an address to the nation, President Uhuru Kenyatta said he accepted the resignation of Police Chief David Kamayo and has nominated a new cabinet secretary for Interior to replace Joseph Olelenku. The changes came after gunmen attacked workers from a quarry in Mandera County near the border with Somalia as they slept in their tents, an attack claimed by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Last week, militants hijacked a bus in a nearby area, killing 28 people. In both incidents, witnesses say non-Muslims were separated and executed. In his address, Mr. Kenyatta tried to deflect the growing criticism of his government's handling of the security situation in the country.
Kenya is at war, and our enemy thrives on sowing panic and despondency in our hearts. We aid this enemy when we succumb to suspicion, fear, finger-pointing, and blame games.
In a news conference, Kamayo said he was taking early retirement for personal reasons. No successor has been named. Mr. Kenyatta announced he was nominating Major General Joseph Nkasari to replace Olelenku. Activists called for both officials to step down during recent protests in Nairobi, demanding better security following several terror attacks in Kenya. The most notable was last year's deadly siege on the Westgate shopping mall, also claimed by Al-Shabaab. President Kenyatta called for Kenyans to support the war on terrorism and continued military involvement in Somalia.
We will not flinch or relent in the war against terrorism in our country and our region. We shall continue to inflict painful casualties on these terrorists until we secure our country and region.
In a statement sent to the media, an Al-Shabaab spokesman said the group's Saleh Naban Brigade carried out Tuesday's attack as part of a continuing response to, quote, Kenya's occupation of Muslim lands. Kenyan defense forces have been active in Somalia since 2011. Last week, Kenyan jets targeted military bases across the border in response to the bus attack. A KDF spokesman told VOA Kenyan forces already in the area are conducting active operations in pursuit of those responsible for Tuesday's attack on quarry workers. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization reports the spread of Ebola is having a damaging impact on the delivery of health services for people suffering from other illnesses in the three severely affected Ebola countries in West Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports one of the root causes of the rapid spread of Ebola in West Africa is linked to the weakness in the health systems of the three heavily infected countries. Ebola has killed around 6,000 people, but WHO Coordinator of Health Systems Gerard Schmitz says the deaths of many more people suffering from malaria, chronic diseases, and other illnesses probably can be linked to Ebola. He says Ebola has damaged the delivery of general services in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. For example, he notes health workers who are caring for Ebola patients are no longer available to work in ordinary health care centers, disrupting important services such as vaccination programs.
For example, pregnant women don't have access to the care they need. Pregnant women don't have access to health centers simply because the health centers are closed because we don't have staff in these health centers anymore. In Guinea, for example, the general consultations and the hospitalization rates have dropped by 50%.
Dr. Schmetz notes health systems in the three countries were very weak well before Ebola struck. For example, in pre-Ebola days, Sierra Leone had 0.2 doctors per 10,000 inhabitants, compared to 2.5 in the rest of Africa and 14 doctors per 10,000 inhabitants in the rest of the world. He says the impact of the epidemic on already shaky health systems is huge and must be urgently addressed.
So we need clearly to focus on Ebola response. We need clearly to focus on rebuilding the general services, but we need also to focus on making the system resilient, to making the system stronger to resist to future epidemics or any disasters in the future.
The World Health Organization is organizing a meeting next week in Geneva focused on building resilient health systems in Ebola-affected countries. Major financial institutions, including the World Bank and the African Development Bank, will participate, as will ministers of health and finance from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Important technical agencies and non-governmental organizations operating in the region also will contribute to creating an action plan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says the international response to the Ebola outbreak has been slow and uneven. The group, also known as MSF, says local people, national governments, and NGOs have done most of the practical hands-on work. MSF warns international community risk failing to adapt to the outbreak after initially failing to respond quickly enough. Also, the World Bank says the Ebola epidemic is having a stark economic impact on Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and is cutting economic growth even more than estimates published a few weeks ago. Before the Ebola crisis, all three nations were growing strongly. Liberia is now expected to grow at a slow 2.2% annual rate. The bank predicts Sierra Leone will expand 4%, one-third of the pre-crisis rates of expansion for these two nations. Guinea's growth projection has been cut from 4.5% before the crisis to just half of 1% now. The financial problems will continue as rising expenses for health care and falling tax revenue strain national budgets. Governments are being forced to move money from infrastructure projects to emergency medical activities. Since the outbreak began in March, more than 7,000 of the 16,000 who contracted the virus have died. There's more information today about attacks on two state capitals yesterday in northern Nigeria. At least five people were reported killed at a market in Maiduguri, capital of Borno State. The Associated Press Wire Service says a vigilante group leader blames the attack on two female suicide bombers. At least 40 people were reported to have serious injuries. A week ago, two female suicide bombers killed 70 people in Maiduguri. Also yesterday, AP reports extremists killed two doctors at a hospital and destroyed buildings at Damaturu, hospital capital of Yobe State. That's about 135 kilometers west of Maiduguri. Police say at least 30 terrorists were killed in the attack. The Boko Haram militant group has been blamed for the attacks. Cameroon says it is recruiting 20,000 more defense and security forces to fight Boko Haram, following reports that the terrorist group based in Nigeria is recruiting young Cameroonians to fight for them. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde.
Senator Haman Paul, who hails from northern Cameroon, spoke to VOA about Boko Haram's recruitment of young Cameroonians to fight for the creation of an Islamist caliphate in northern Nigeria.
That was something that we witnessed with our eyes in Marwa. People told us actually that they found people in town that were not people that they were used to. Listen, when you find that one part of the country is in a very delicate situation, you better manage prevention and facts instead of trying to manage consequences.
A lawmaker from northern Cameroon, Sally Dairu, said just last week Boko Haram seized cattle from Cameroonian ranchers who lived along the border with Nigeria's Borno and Adamawa states, a stronghold of the militant group. He says the ranchers have lost thousands of cattle.
Ils ont tué tous les bergers qui étaient partis avec les bœufs là-bas, et les bœufs se sont retrouvés.
Sally Dairu said the militants killed some of the cattle ranchers and thousands of their cows went into the wild. He said this was a huge loss and no rancher has the courage to go to the boundary with Nigeria and bring back his remaining cattle. Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, René Emmanuel Sadi, says the threat posed by Boko Haram has led many people from the border areas to flee.
C'est la région de l'extrême nord qui paye le plus lourd tribut. Plusieurs écoles sont restées fermées.
He says northern Cameroon is the hardest hit as many schools have remained closed and people are abandoning their farms and cattle. René Emmanuel Sadi says Boko Haram has paralyzed trade between Cameroon and Nigeria that had supplied 80% of foodstuffs and basic necessities to northern Cameroon since the two countries gained independence more than 5 decades ago.
Le prix du carburant frelaté importé du Nigeria est très utilisé localement et régulièrement.
He says the economy of northern Cameroon is collapsing because even Nigerian fuel that is widely used is no longer available and that business transactions and commercial activity have been paralyzed by Boko Haram. Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Bengo, says besides the economic hardship, atrocities committed by the militant group have led to a massive movement of more than 30,000 villagers to areas of the country away from the border.
Boko Haram mène des actions ponctuelles commando, d'assassinat par égorgement public.
He says fear gripped the people when Boko Haram started arresting and publicly killing religious leaders and chiefs who collaborate with the government of Cameroon in some villages that are neighbors of Nigeria's Borno state. Another effect of the unrest has been that commercial banks are unable to recover loans granted to farmers and cattle ranchers and now have decided not to give loans to people along Cameroon's border with Nigeria. Cameroon's police chief, Martin Bagangele, says in response to all of this, the country has decided to recruit some 20,000 defense and security forces to fight and restore security in the border areas.
Le chef de l'État vient de décider le recrutement cette année de 4,700 policiers.
He says Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, has instructed him to recruit 4,700 policemen this year and 5,000 next year, and that the military was also recruiting at least 6,000 Cameroonian youths this year. Cameroon joined Nigeria, Benin, Chad and Niger in sharing intelligence and border surveillance. Cameroon is working with the four African nations and the United States, France, China and Germany in a new regional African effort against the extreme Islamists. Boko Haram has been working to impose Islamic Sharia law in Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Climate Change Conference is underway in Lima, Peru. Officials from about 190 countries are attending the meeting. The Associated Press has reviewed climate data from recent decades. It says between 1983 and 1992, the world averaged nearly 150 climate, water, and weather disasters each year. That number has now climbed to more than 300 per year.
The cost for weather-related losses after being adjusted for inflation was $1 billion a year between 1983 and 1992. The Associated Press says between 2004 and 2013, the average annual loss was more than $130 billion a year. Princeton University professor of geosciences Michael Oppenheimer says people are rapidly changing the planet and are beginning to suffer the consequences. In the past 20 years, the AP says data indicate that carbon emissions have risen 60%. Malawi President Peter Mutharika is under fire for giving envelopes containing $125 to more than 80 media people at a dinner he hosted last month in Blantyre. The editor of the privately owned Times Television said reporters were told the envelopes contain the president's plans for the media, which has been critical of the government's economic performance. Lamek Messina has more from Blantyre on the ethics and political implications of the incident.
In his column published in the Sunday Times newspaper, editor Gretchen Dugula said he was not sure why the money was given to the journalists at the state dinner. Dugula said he initially decided to return the money, but reversed the decision to avoid creating a scene. But the editor for the Weekend Nation newspaper, George Kasakula, told VOA that he returned the money right away.
I just felt it was not right for me to get the money, and he returned it. My understanding is that if somebody invites me to a workshop, it's their duty to make sure that they feed me, they accommodate me, and they transport me. But in this case, I didn't see why I should get that allowance, because I didn't spend anything to go to Sanchika.
The issue has attracted more public attention after privately owned Capital Radio aired a story questioning the meaning of the cash handouts from the president. Stephen Dagalila is the head of the news and current affairs at Capital Radio.
As Capital FM, we serve the interests of the public. This issue, it has been all over the social media. And even if us, as a media, we are implicated on such matters, it is paramount that we do follow up and get to the bottom of the matter.
In his column in the Nyasa Times, Malawi professor of law, Donald Nsikenge Chirwa, says what President Mutharika did by giving money handouts to journalists at a news event was tantamount to bribery. He has called on Mr. Mutharika to resign or face impeachment proceedings. Local civil society groups said that by attempting to bribe the journalists, Mr. Mutharika subjected his leadership style to disrepute. Meanwhile, some journalists are donating the money to charity. Brian Ligomeka is the managing editor for the Times Group. He told Times Television that all the employees there have donated the money to an orphanage. He says at first they decided to return the money to the president, but later thought it wise to buy assorted items like sugar, salt, notebooks, and donate it to the needy children. In his latest Sunday Times column, Raphael Tentani, who also writes for BBC, apologized on behalf of the other journalists for letting down the public that trusts journalists unreservedly. Tentani has since donated the money for charity work and says although the journalists could have done better if they returned the money right away, doing so would have been perceived as disrespect to the head of state. Maklani Kanyangwa heads the Department of Journalism and Media Studies at the Polytechnic College of the University of Malawi. He says media code of ethics bar journalists from accepting payment on a story.
Obviously, the meeting at the palace was a newsworthy event. There was a possibility that something was going to be published. And in the event that maybe this payment was going to influence maybe a journalist's decision, then that becomes a problem.
Kanyangwa says he feels many journalists failed to return the money immediately because they might have been out of their ethical senses when they got the money. Efforts to talk to Presidential Press Officer Frederick Ndala were not successful, but some government authorities say the payment was not a bribe but meant for fuel refund to those who attended the night event. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
24 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Egypt's public prosecutor says he will appeal a Cairo court decision acquitting ex-president Hosni Mubarak and seven of his security officers of killing hundreds of demonstrators. The charges stem from the 2011 Arab Spring protest in Tahrir Square. More than 1,000 people gathered at Tahrir Square Saturday to protest the acquittal after it was made public. Two demonstrators died and several were wounded in clashes with security forces. The prosecutor general's office says the acquittal was marred by a legal flaw. A higher court can now confirm or cancel the acquittal. Mr. Mubarak, who's 86, has been held for 3 years in a military hospital. Egyptian authorities say the country's sagging tourism industry is bouncing back with a huge increase in visitors during the summer and early fall. But as resorts and historical sites enjoy the business, analysts say continued insecurity makes the sector in Egypt volatile and not profitable enough to fix the country's beleaguered economy. Heather Murdoch has more from the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh.
On the shores and under the water of this resort town in the Sinai Peninsula, tourists see none of the insecurity the region is known best for in the news. Egyptian officials say they hope by next year to return the tourism industry to its pre-2011 glory, when the industry pulled in more than $12 billion in a year. Egyptian tourism minister Hisham Zazu says the hope and the challenge is to be able to report a significant restoration of the sector in the first part of next year. But analysts say this challenge is considerable because the industry relies on international public perception of safety in Egypt at a time of continued unrest. Lebanese American University political science professor Sami Baradi calls for economic diversity.
Tourism is a very important but volatile sector. So you cannot pin your economic strategy on a sector that one or two bombings or one or two basically assassinations may impact adversely.
For Egypt to alleviate widespread crushing poverty, he says, the country needs to invest in industry and export goods. But unlike the export business, he adds, Egypt's tourism industry already has the infrastructure and the expertise in place.
So we have to bear in mind all the investments that have been done in the tourism sector, all the jobs in Egypt that are tied to tourism. And, you know, the government cannot but give high priority to this sector.
But economists say even if the government succeeds in convincing visitors to once again crowd into its cities and on its shores, the country will still need to rely heavily on foreign aid to keep afloat after 3 years of political turmoil that collapsed two Egyptian governments. Marwan Iskander is a senior economist with Bank Faron and Chiha in Lebanon.
It's not enough to help Egypt to take off because the events that took place from 2011 till 2013 had hindered the growth of the economy significantly.
Protests and clashes continue in Egypt, threatening to dial back some of the recent successes in the tourism industry. On the other hand, Iskander says new markets are opening up with a large increase in Russian tourists in Egypt in recent years. And tour guides here say despite the insecurity, they, like the iconic Nile River, will endure indefinitely. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
It's difficult to recognize Ebola because the signs, sudden fever, diarrhea, vomiting, are shared by other diseases. It's quite difficult for anyone, except a healthcare worker, to say definitively, yes, it is Ebola, or no, it is not Ebola. So if you have sudden fever, diarrhea, or vomiting, and you have been in direct contact with someone who is sick, you should go to the health center, because no matter the cause, you can receive help there. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenya's president announces the replacement of his interior minister and police chief hours after a military attack that left 36 people dead. Cameroon says it is recruiting 20,000 more defense and security forces to fight Boko Haram. And the Ebola epidemic is having a stark economic impact on Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Well, coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a South African athlete tops your sports report today.
Kim, our starting line on the Sunny Side of Sports is African athletics. It's been a great year for South African hurdler Cornell Fredericks, who won three major titles in July, August, and September. In July, the 24-year-old Fredericks won the gold in the 400-meter hurdles at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland. In August, Fredericks won gold again at the African Championships in Marrakesh, Morocco. And in September, also in Marrakesh, Fredericks won more gold at the IAAF Continental Cup competition. The South African athlete discussed his memorable year with our Daybreak Africa sportsman in Johannesburg, Mark Ouma.
South Africa's Cornell Fredericks says winning the 400-meter hurdles gold medal at the British Commonwealth Games spurred him on to the most successful year of his career.
It was a successful year for me. I didn't expect three gold medals in 1 year. My goal this season was just to run consistent 48 seconds and also just to win a medal at the Commonwealth Games. That was my biggest goal for this season. When I got to the Commonwealth Games, I decided that I came all the way to the final, not just to be in the final, but to actually win the final, and I put in everything, and at the end of the day, everything worked out for me.
That must have opened the floodgates for the Africa Championships and later the Continental Cup.
I got so much confidence from that win in Glasgow. After beating the world champion, Jayu Gordon, in the Commonwealth Games, gave me a lot of confidence and also a big boost for the Africa Champs. I never won an African title at senior level, so I wanted to prove myself that I'm one of the best in Africa in 400-meter hurdles. I got the opportunity to also represent Africa at the Continental Championships. That was also a big achievement in my career at the moment. There I got to run against Javier Coulson of Puerto Rico and Michael Tinsley, who is currently the Olympic silver medalist and world silver medalist, and I got to beat them both in a once-off race, and that was also a big highlight in my career so far.
That was South Africa's Cornell Fredericks, the British Commonwealth Games, the Africa champion, and the IAAF Continental Cup 400-meter hurdle gold medalist. The Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
African football fans are looking forward to Wednesday's 2015 Nations Cup draw in Malabo, the capital of Equatorial Guinea. Equatorial Guinea, which co-hosted the 2012 Nations Cup with Gabon, stepped in as an emergency replacement for next month's tournament when Morocco backed out because of Ebola fears. During Wednesday's draw, 16 teams will be divided into four groups of four. The 16 qualifiers are, in alphabetical order, Algeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Congo-Brazzaville, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Mali, Senegal, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. Our African football guru, David Legg, says with nine former champions in the field, it's shaping up as a very intriguing and competitive Nations Cup. The tournament kicks off January 17th, and the final will be played February 8th. Elsewhere in African football, Ghana and D.C. United defender Samuel Nkum recently visited our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. Samuel was a member of Ghana's World Cup teams at South Africa 2010 and Brazil 2014. After stops in Switzerland, Ukraine, France, and Greece, Samuel just finished his first season with Major League Soccer's D.C. United club, which is based here in Washington. And Samuel sat down for a chat with me and my longtime sporty colleague, Rokia Hyder, the chief of the VOA's Bangla service. Let's listen in now as I ask Samuel about where he got his start playing football in Ghana.
Yes, I was in Sekendi Takoradi. That's the place I started from.
You started your school there and then started playing soccer, or you started rolling the ball before you got into inside the school?
No, I was in school. I was in school. During the school, we have something like inter-college.
Uh-huh.
We used to play like under 12 tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scouted by a great coach in Ghana. Now he's the sporting director of Ghana Blasters team now.
Okay, okay.
So whose interest it was, your own or your parents? That you should go into soccer field?
I think it was my parents. Sometimes my mom used to hold my hands, let's go. And she would sit down when I finished training. She was encouraging me, my dad and my
mom.
How
old were you?
I was 12 years at that time. I was 12 years.
Now, at that point, Samuel, who were, I'm sure you were aware of the Black Stars, but who were some of the big names at that time when you were just growing up?
Steven Appiah. Michael Essien, great players. So at that time, if you can remember, Steven Appiah was in Juventus.
Yes, yes.
Michael Essien was in, I think, is it Chelsea? I think Lyon also. So I think it was a great name. So, yeah.
But were you interested over the years? You got attracted towards foreign lands. And as we know, you were in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I was playing in Kotoko. In Ghana,
okay.
The name of the team was Kotoko.
Okay.
So I think they were a scout from Switzerland. I think they came to watch a couple of games. When they saw me, they were saying good stuff about me.
They selected and they knew what you can do.
They see I have the talent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we went to under 20 tournament, which is African tournament in Luanda. And after Luanda, we went to Egypt for the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the World Cup. So after the World Cup, like they made see like, okay, then let's
never looking back.
Yeah, so I signed a contract and I started playing Basel, FC Basel, which is in Switzerland.
Great.
You have a strong history with the Black Satellites.
Yeah.
Also, that's the younger national team for Ghana.
Yeah.
Did that sort of help your entry into the national team, the Black Stars?
Yeah, of course, yes. I think it was great for me. I remember I was in Kotoko and the coach came and watched me, the senior team of Blasters.
Okay.
The coach came and watched me. When he watched me about, I think, 30 minutes, and at that time the Blaster need to travel, and he said to the management, I want to travel with this young boy. So when he came to the dressing room talking to me, I was like surprised. I said, oh, wow.
Obviously.
I was surprised. And he told me that we are traveling with you tonight. I said, oh. It was amazing. You know, uh-huh.
How was it, you know, in like as we know, in 2009, you played in under 20 soccer. And you helped, I mean, your skill and your goals helped Ghana to defeat Brazil.
Yeah.
You know, Brazil has this big awe that, Brazil, the World Cup champion, five. Of course, they didn't do much this time, this year's football in Brazil.
Yeah.
But how did it feel at that time?
I think when we mention, like, when we are talking about soccer and you talk about Brazil, everybody know what they can do. They have big names as well. And the young team, they played very good as well. I think it was we were focused.
Focused,
extra focus, I'm telling you. Like, we were, like, determination that every we need to take the cup. And we were even down. They gave one of our players a red card, so we were playing 10 against 11.
Wow.
Imagine. Wow. So we played about, let's say, 120 minutes, and we went to the penalties. And I took the second one.
Okay. And I know you made it.
I scored.
Samuel, let's talk a little bit about Major League Soccer. How were you first approached by either MLS or DC United? How did they reach out to you?
I had a call with the coach, the manager, which was Benny, and he was talking to me. I need to come and help. And, you know, he was talking to me. I said, you know, he has played football before. He know what is good. So he was talking to me as, like, he want to develop me as well. So it sounds good to me. So I came, and he's a great coach. Trust me, he's a very good coach. He know what he's doing. I think he has played before. That's why everything is going smooth.
Right.
So I think he's
and as we know, that America is a country of great opportunities.
Yeah.
And there is opportunity in the field of soccer also.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Of course, yes. I think for me, MLS League, like I told you, it's great league. I've been in Europe, I've been in France, I've been in Ukraine, I've been in Basel, I've been in Greece. And MLS League also is great league.
That's Ghanaian defender Samuel Nkum, who plays for Major League Soccer's DC United club. And Samuel was talking with me and my VOA colleague, Rokia Hyder, at our Voice of America studios here in Washington. In pro basketball news, the Philadelphia 76ers are closing in on a record for futility, a mark I'm sure they don't want to own. Philadelphia lost to the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs Monday night, 109-103. The defeat extended Philadelphia's club-worst losing streak to start the season to 17 games. The 76ers can tie the Nets for the worst start in NBA history. That's 18 consecutive losses if they lose on Wednesday night to the Minnesota Timberwolves. And the 76ers could break the record at home in Philadelphia on Friday if they lose again to the Oklahoma City Thunder. Kawhi Leonard, the most valuable player in last season's NBA Finals, had a game-high 26 points for San Antonio Monday night. The Spurs played without two of their big stars, Tim Duncan and Tony Parker. Parker has a sore shoulder while they rested Duncan. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, an organization aims to increase the speed and efficiency of international donors in health matters. And some Kenyan lawmakers are calling for a ban on genetically modified crops. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Chachi Shadase of Ethiopia with Hungry Children.
Dying baby.
Tedese of Ethiopia with Hungry Children. While Africa business leaders, officials of development finance institutions, and members of African Union countries recently committed to funding mechanisms for the Ebola outbreak. They committed over $28 million to an emergency fund during a recent African roundtable summit on Ebola in Addis Ababa. Observers say the last decade has been dramatic increases in donor funding for global health, but recipients often experience delays in accessing the funds. Aaron Betru is the managing director of Pledge Guarantee for Health, a financing partnership to increase the speed and efficiency of international donors in health matters. He explained to VOA's Lenore Madu how his organization works.
It's not necessarily just the amount of money that we make pledges, but actually how fast we move them. I think the best way to explain it is to tell you a quick short story. In 2011, we had a situation where in Zambia, they were waiting on a $5 million pledge from the World Bank. And this money was going to go specifically for the purchase of malaria bed nets for an impending rainy season that they were going to have. Mm-hmm. But the issue that was faced was the timing between when the pledges were made or even when the grants were agreed upon to the time that they were going to be in the hands of the procurement agents to buy the bed nets and deliver them in time was going to be 8 to 10 months. Now, here's a perfect situation where why should we be waiting?
Yes, indeed. So why should we be waiting? How can we accelerate this process? And perhaps that's where you come in.
Absolutely. And so what we ended up doing in cooperation with the UN Special Envoy for Innovative Financing, as well as the World Bank and UNICEF, we provided what is normal in the private sector. We provided a financial guarantee to Standard Bank of South Africa. Standard Bank of South Africa opened up a line of credit for the Ministry of Health, and the nets were procured and started rolling in within 3 weeks. It's a simple process. It's not, even though we call it in our world innovative financing, mm-hmm. but effectively it's a credit card that allows us to move rapidly to the needs in the country today and just avoid all the pitfalls around the slow response time that's typical in this industry.
Are there some fees associated with this?
Yes, there are some interest expenses that are associated with this, mm-hmm. but what we try to do is work with the private sector, work with either the commercial banks to lower their fees, work with the suppliers to actually absorb the cost of the financing. And in every single case, we've actually been able to make the cost completely negligible. And we have to think about the actual cost on the other side of it, of not acting, of not moving fast.
Yes.
Forget about the number of lives saved, which is paramount, but there's also all the inefficiencies that we get from just inefficient uses of aid, mm-hmm. from switching from sea freighting to air freighting, all these different things.
Sometimes corruption. People talk about,
absolutely.
You know, it's one of the issues, but not the only thing.
No, absolutely. How you account for that money and how you use it. Now, mm-hmm. when you're bringing in all the private sector and the special places that we do, at the end of the day, you get better governance and better oversight, as well as rapid response and recouping all that inefficient use of the money.
What have you observed with the Ebola crisis specifically?
I think one of the things we can easily point to is I think the UN Special Envoy recently identified that, yes, the need that was originally calculated by OSHA was about $1 billion. Mm-hmm. Looks like it's actually going to be an extra $500 million going through to the next year. And of that, the trust fund that has been set up, only about 120 commitments and pledges have been placed. But of that, only 13 million has actually arrived and 8 million actually deployed. See how quickly we've gone from 1.5 billion to just 8 million on the ground.
That's mind-boggling. We hear these big numbers, and then at the end of the day, either it doesn't get there quickly enough or... But how do people take advantage of your program? Are countries or NGOs aware of what is being put in place here?
So recently, the U.S. government and the Swedish government banded together to support the creation of a $100 million guarantee fund, where we took that and partnered with some private sector players like EcoBank and Calvert Foundation to create a $100 million rapid response fund, which basically means when you've got pledges in hand and you actually need to move faster, we'll place a financial guarantee with these financing partners that will turn on the capital as quickly as possible so you can have the money to buy these temporary health centers or mobile hospital units and move them into the facility very quickly. I think there was an article written recently at the New York Times, I think yesterday or the day before, where the UN envoy, Dr. Nabarro, said, you know, we need to shift away from building these 100-plus large mega centers in places like in Monrovia, where the spread has flatlined a little bit, and have these fast response ones that can go into places like Sierra Leone, where the rates are increasing.
That's Aaron Betrew of Pledge Guarantee for Health. He was speaking with VOA's Lenore Madu. With a virus threatening the crops of up to 70% of Kenya's maize farmers, a number of lawmakers are calling for the country's controversial ban on genetically modified organisms to be lifted for the sake of food security. Hillary Hewler has more from Nairobi.
If there's one thing you're almost guaranteed to find in a Kenyan kitchen, it's corn, known locally as maize. Corn is roasted by the side of the road, boiled with beans, or ground into a flour to make ugali, a Kenyan staple. Agricultural researcher Simon Gichuki explains that for many Kenyans, maize is an irreplaceable part of their diet.
They eat maize almost every day. There are people who eat it lunch, they also eat it for dinner and at breakfast. So when there is no maize in Kenya, we usually say there is famine. Even when the other crops are doing well, like bananas, cassava, sweet potatoes, we say there's famine.
This is why the past several years have been so alarming for Kenyans. The country's cereal-growing heartlands have been ravaged by a virus called maize lethal necrosis disease. The Cereal Growers Association has said the disease could cut production this year by almost a third, with up to 70% of maize farmers affected. According to Kipkorir Menjo, head of the Kenya Farmers Association, the virus could be a threat to food security. In Kenya, more and more policymakers are starting to think that the solution to diseases like this is genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. GMOs have been banned in Kenya since 2012, when a study found that GMO maize caused cancer in rats. The study was later discredited and pulled from the scientific journal that had published it. But in Kenya, GMOs are still illegal. Gichuki, who runs the biotechnology unit at the Kenya Agricultural and Livestock Research Organization, says Kenyan scientists are already talking to foreign universities to start work on a lethal necrosis disease-resistant maize. Several other types of GMO maize have been harvested already, including one crop in October. Menjo says that among farmers themselves, opinions on GMOs are mixed. But a number of lawmakers have been speaking out in favor of lifting the ban.
The pressure is from the MPs because they know the benefits and why these kind of GMOs are necessary as far as food security is concerned. Because every now and then we have been having challenges of having enough food to feed the nation.
GMOs are still controversial in Kenya, and although Menjo supports legalizing them, he says many people are concerned about their potential side effects.
You find that the unintended results is what most people fear, because who is controlling to ensure that we have the positive results coming in and not the negative side of it? That is basically what makes people to be a bit skeptical.
But Gichuki is convinced it won't be long before he and his team of scientists will be able to distribute their newly created GMO seeds to farmers.
The government is very serious with food security, so I don't see any reason why this ban is going to be there for long. It will definitely be lifted. And we in research are not just waiting, we are moving on, preparing, because we are confident that it will be lifted.
Kenya's GMO ban can only be lifted by the cabinet, which has yet to make a decision. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 76th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, when 267 synagogues and 7,500 businesses owned by Jews, as well as Jewish homes, schools, and hospitals, were destroyed or damaged by Nazis in Germany and Austria. More than 90 people were killed over the course of the night. In Vienna, 91 synagogues were destroyed. The voices speaking out against the events of Kristallnacht were few in 1938, said U.S. Chargé d'Affaires to the U.S. Mission to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Kate Burns. Very few governments condemned the violence, and very few religious leaders protested the cruelty perpetrated against Jews. As we remember Kristallnacht, said Ms. Burns, let us remember our moral responsibility, both as government officials and as individuals, to speak out against all forms of hatred and intolerance. Unfortunately, anti-Semitism is not a thing of the past. It is worth recalling, said Chargé Burns, that the OSCE has a rich body of commitments to combat anti-Semitism and intolerance and discrimination more broadly. All participating states should implement these common commitments. The United States urges participating states that have not already done so to enact appropriate legislation to combat hate crimes, collect data on the commission of these crimes, provide appropriate training to law enforcement and assistance to victimized communities, engage civil society to promote tolerance, and promote inclusion of minority groups. No participating OSCE state is immune from intolerance, said Ms. Burns, and we must work together to prevent discrimination and hatred from gaining currency in our societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.